General Government Subcommittee Ways and Means. Today we're scheduled for public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2734. 2734, our legislative fiscal officer today is representing fiscal offices Jordan, and Jamie Benn is our clerk, and we have some testimony that has been provided, that has been passed out, handed out, and we've got, let's see, let's make sure that, it looks like we've got the State Treasurer's Office, Department of Administrative Services, ODOT, DMV, and Department of Justice. Do we have anyone here from the State Treasurer's Office or Department of Administrative Services or DMV? Okay, yeah, Kelly here. Okay, let's go ahead and have Ms. Jordan bring us up to date. I understand we're going to be late on Representative Krupp, and I haven't heard from Representative Hansen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill establishes an 11-member recovery fund governing board, seven members that are appointed by the Attorney General's Office and the Director of the Department of Transportation. And it creates a recovery fund for paying claims and expenses of the Recovery Fund Governing Board. And then that provides that the claims payable by the fund are limited to amounts unpaid to consumers arising from final judgments, settlement agreements, and assurances of voluntary compliance involving dealer fraud or vehicle code violations, reimbursement to the Departments of Justice and Transportation, and if approved by the Governing Board, claim-related attorney fees. And then it also provides, of course, funds for the recovery funds and dealer fees. And you have in front of you the staff measure summary and the fiscal impact statement in our office.
Before we got started in our public hearing portion, I had begun to ask the questions relative to the fees being charged now in relationship to the fees anticipated under Section 3. I just need to make sure, and that's what you've got under effective revenues, the vehicle dealer certificate fees, the present fees that they presently pay. I'll make sure they're
35.
And they're going to be 90.
And they're going to
95.
Mm-hmm.
There's four different fees. There's renewals at 95, supplemental locations at 30, additional plates at 10, and additional plates for motorcycle at 3.
Mr. Chairman, can I interrupt you for a second? The fiscal impact on the original bill, not the A in gross, which is that it got the stuff. So you're looking at wrong information. Excuse me for interrupting.
Okay. All right.
Well, I told her.
Okay. Could we use this fiscal information for the legislative budget? Maybe we could put this in the legislative budget. Could maybe show that we can get something done so we can get a budget passed through the legislature. Alright. Well, maybe we better set that aside then. And we have Mr. Shepard from the Department of Justice come forward and let us know what we have here.
Members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm special counsel to Attorney General Hardy Myers, and until July 1st, when I became special counsel, I have been the head of our consumer protection and financial fraud section for 5 years. I'm joined today, if I might, with the pleasure of the committee, by Mr. Fuller, as he is here on behalf of the Oregon Automobile Dealers Association, also supporting the bill. Let me briefly describe for the committee the nature of the problem. I'll spend just a minute or two on the history of how this proposal reaches the committee, and then elaborate a little bit on the basic concept of the fund, and perhaps address some of the key issues that have been presented in brief to the committee already by the staff. The basic problem arises because when a dealership fails, it's consumers who end up holding the short straw. The banks and other dealers, other business interests generally are protected by security interests that they hold in various forms of collateral that the dealership has. And as a consequence, it's consumers, ordinary citizens, who end up taking a loss when a dealership fails.
That's very true. Could you give us an example of what those losses might be for the ordinary consumer?
Chair Senator Trow, let me give you an example from the failure of Selective Motors, a dealership in Eugene. A Eugene couple had traded in a truck for another car and $1,000 that the dealer promised to pay the consumers as part of the transaction. The dealer then closed its doors, locked up the doors, and the consumers never got their $1,000. There was an Albany couple who consigned the car to the same dealership.
Excuse me, Mr. Shepard, let me just ask, is the $15,000 loan that we've got presently on that dealer that's going to $25,000, would that be part of the covered transaction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, I believe that $1,000 would constitute would be a basis for a claim against the bond under the current law. The problem is that the bond is vanishingly small in the face of the cumulative losses that the consumers usually suffer. In the 1997 failure of the Oregon Auto Group, Quality Auto Care Company, for example, a lawyer for one of the claimants there wrote me a letter and indicated that the claimants received 7 cents on the dollar, the consumer claimants received 7 cents on the dollar on their losses in the failure of that dealership, notwithstanding the presence of the bond, which is going to be increased, as the chair has indicated, this session by legislation we supported to $25,000, but that's still going to be too small to deal with these losses. Over the last 15 years, the losses have ranged in cumulative total from $272,000 in the failure of Valley Chevrolet with 210 consumer victims to about $43,000 in the failure of Nice Toys and Nice Autos and Clean Toys, which only had two victims in the Portland area. The dilemma for us is that we can't raise the bond sufficiently to cover those kinds of losses without driving out of business some legitimate companies, because the underwriting requirements then become so great that companies with low capitalization but nonetheless doing business in full compliance with all the consumer protection laws can't get the necessary license. So we began working on this dilemma back in June of 1997. We've had 6 meetings of a working group that included all of the interested parties. We've had many, many different drafts of the proposal that reaches you today. And as a result of that, the Oregon Independent Automobile Dealers Association, the Oregon State Bar Consumer Law Section, the Oregon Consumer League, and Mr. Fuller's organization all joined the Department of Justice in commending this legislation to you with the Dash 85 amendment.
Were those somebody there representing the bonding company? in that group.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trove, there were representatives of the bonding companies, but I don't want to misrepresent their position. They are, I understand, opposed the bill. And
do, but were they represented in the group?
They were participants at various stages. I don't know that they attended every meeting of the working group, but they certainly were invited and received the materials. The basic concept of the bond is, as your staff, or the fund, rather, is as your staff has described. The target balance for this fund would be approximately $700,000. That's based on a rough estimate of three times the worst-case scenario that we've seen in the last 15 years. The fund would be managed through a governing board that would be composed jointly of industry and individual citizens. The fund would be dispersed by the governing board to consumer claimants under very limited conditions to compensate them for the fraud of the dealers, fraud which is otherwise uncompensated by the bond, or otherwise uncompensated by recovery from the dealer, rather. Now,
I'm sorry, I beg your pardon. Representative Leonard,
the $700,000 you said is three times the worst case scenario. That's an individual case,
Mr. Chair. Representative Leonard, no, that is roughly three times the worst case scenario, which was around $272,000 Chevrolet case.
That is an individual case.
That was the total amount of loss suffered by all of the consumers in that case. There were 210 victims.
I mean, in one incident.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, that's correct. One case.
What is the average annual loss? Because isn't this to be used statewide?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, the way the -A5 amendments operate is that a consumer who obtains a judgment against a dealer must first take all reasonable steps to collect that judgment from the dealer. If the dealer is still in business, then the consumer will get their payment ultimately after exhausting their reasonable steps from the dealer. And so that claim would not be presented to the fund. The claims that will likely reach this fund then will be cases in which the dealership has gone under, is no longer in business, and has no assets to satisfy the judgment that the consumer has obtained. And so the consumer would be required, before they could turn to the fund, to attempt to collect from the dealer in the usual fashion. And so the ongoing payments that, the ongoing claims, if you will, would probably not reach this fund if the dealer is still in business.
Are you going to get into Section 3 in your remarks? If not, I'd like to ask you about that in terms of dealers, as I understand it, that are in business four or more consecutive years don't pay into the fund and why that is. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, let me address those, the fees for the dealers. The fees are as you have described. Dealers who have been in business three or more consecutive years are not required to pay. Four or more consecutive years, up to 3 years. Dealers in their first 3 years of business have to pay into the fund. And then in the fourth year, they're exempted from further payment into the fund. And the reason for that is that as nearly as we could discern from looking at in the working group at the history in Oregon, and also based on the information from two other jurisdictions in which similar funds are working well, there is a higher probability that dealers in the early part of their existence will fail and thus leave consumers with uncompensated losses than there is that dealers who have been in business a longer period of time will fail. That's not exclusively true. Some of the examples we've had have been dealers who have been in business a longer time than 4 years.
Follow up. Did the work group discuss that this could actually have the effect of protecting people who have been in business four or more years and help keep out of business new dealerships?
Mr. Chair, Representative Warner, that indeed was a consideration that the Department of Justice examined. I can't speak for any other member of the working group, but it certainly is. There are trade-offs, unquestionably, whenever the cost of entry into a new market is increased. for the Department of Justice, our judgment was that the first-year payment that's required under the bill of a new dealer entering the market is $650. And it struck us as unlikely that the additional requirements and entry barrier of $650 would prevent anyone who was otherwise able to go into business as a car dealer from being able to enter that market and compete.
And a dealer is defined as what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, that a dealer is a defined term that's on in the first section of the bill on page 1 at lines beginning on line 12.
But, yeah, it, but it says, it makes reference to ORS 822-831. What criteria just...
Sure.
A person at home who sold more than X amount of cars a year from their home?
Sure. I think that Mr. Fuller probably can give you the working definition, but essentially I believe the current law is more than 5 cars in a year. I don't recall the exact number, but there is a lower limit that has been established.
And so that a person who fell under that definition of more than 5 cars or whatever it is would fall under the provisions of Section 3 and the fees associated with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, that's correct, unless they were exempted by one of the exemptions from the definition of dealer.
One of the concerns I have, and perhaps you can speak to this, is that if the fund is not replenished by adequate money, if there are significant claims against it, it could dry up. And I don't know whether the mechanism is there to keep it replenished. I know we've had other such funds. We had one in the area of the water irrigation, as I recall. And we put general fund in it, and then the fund dried up. There were some big claims against it, and suddenly we had a fund that was supposed to do something but didn't have any money. And we had the choice of putting a lot more money into it or canceling it. I forget what we did with the thing finally. But what about how is this going to be replenished so it stays a viable fund?
Chair Senator Trow, we were concerned about that as well, and in Section 3 on page 3 of the bill, at lines 8 and 9, the governing board is authorized to impose a special assessment, which would be capped at $300 per dealer.
So it can do that.
And it would have authority to do that in order to maintain the target balance of $700,000.
So at all times there's a mechanism to keep it at $700,000, to keep the money there, and those dealers who seem to be excused from paying would have to pay as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, that's correct. All dealers would be subject to the special assessment in the event that the government weren't found necessary to impose such a special assessment.
Let me back up from right there for just a moment. That $300 is on top of the assessments to dealers down under paragraph 2 in Section 3 on the bottom of page 2, A, B, and C, the $650, the $300, and $150. Those are separate from the $300 perpetual fee that would be needed as to be assessed against each dealer in the future to keep the target balance back up to $700,000. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's partially correct. So I would point out that the $300 special, the maximum, the special assessment that's capped at $300. Is not imposed unless it is the stream of regular payments under the schedule of $650 for the first year, $300 for the second, and $150 for the third, unless that's insufficient to sustain the fund. And the experience in the province of Ontario, Canada, and in the state of Virginia, where similar funds are operating, is that these funds, in fact, turn out to be probably will be self-sustaining, and that's our best estimate of this, that the required payments of newly entering dealers will be sufficient to sustain the fund, notwithstanding the cost. So there is this backup authority that I discussed for the special assessment in the event it's necessary to replenish the fund if there are large losses. But that fee is not automatically charged, so it wouldn't be accurate to say that a dealer entering the market for the first time would have to pay a $950 fee.
let me ask this. The 950, that's the 650 plus the 300 special assessment. So it could be that new dealers coming on board would pay a total of $950 in year four or five or six if they were a brand new dealer. But this sunset, in my recollection, in 2004, is that right? At which time the money, all of the $700,000, goes to the Highway Trust Fund, as I recall.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. If a dealer entering the market for the first time, let's say entering the market for the first time after the bill becomes effective, theoretically, well, actually, I don't see any way that a dealer in the first year of the operation of the fund would be required to pay $950 because there wouldn't have been claims at that point. So the dealer in the first year of the operation of the fund is likely to pay $650. But to take your question, in the third year, let's say, and there have been a lot of claims on the fund, and in the third year of operation of the fund, a new dealer comes into the market, it is possible that that dealer would have to pay $950. That's correct.
Okay. All right. And then let me, the reason I asked about the Department of Administrative Services earlier is it appears to me that there's a number of things that have to be administered relative to the fund itself. I mean, the first person that comes up in this bill is the treasurer, and the interest distributions on a first-in, first-out basis to the dealers, after you've accumulated $700,000, you've got all of this interest. And I assume that's after all of the administrative fees with no payout for any defaulting beyond a bond. But I'm wondering, do we have any idea how much of a bond we could buy through risk management of the Department of Administrative Services for, say, $100,000 statewide, or $200,000, or even $700,000? What kind of a perpetual bond, or the interest off the $700,000? Have any ideas at that particular point if risk management involved in any of the discussions, Department of Administrative Services?
Mr. Chair, risk management was not.
Okay. I'm wondering if we're not in search of a problem here. So that's why I question relative to risk management, if we shouldn't take a look and see how much of a bond. If $25,000 is going to keep a lot of folks out, and $700,000 is set up as a perpetual fund with these other fees that could be used to replenish the fund and the special assessment, I'm wondering, and I guess we'll have testimony from the bond folks, but I'm wondering how much additional bond a person could buy for $300. I have experience with a $50,000 bond for a couple of $100. Maybe another $300 could buy them $100,000 or $200,000 bond. That's why I say I'm wondering if they're not in search of a problem here. So, but I wanted to just make sure that what you're saying then is that after this program has been in effect for 3 years or 4 years, a new dealer could come on board and could be looking for potentially as much as $650 as a new application fee, and on top of that, an additional $300 as a special assessment, because people see this as deep pockets and have a label of Tsumi, and see if you can get to the $700,000 limit.
You still have to buy a bond, too.
Yeah, you still have to buy a bond, and it's $25,000, but as has been indicated, I think the Valley Chevrolet case, in which there were over 200 claimants, was 272,000. And this has been based upon, this figure has been based upon three times the amount to come up with $700,000. So, okay. Representative Hanson, recognize.
In the same vein, this fund, you could only continue to access it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, that's correct.
Thinking back to some of these other incidents where you've had dollars going against the bonding company, were there also liens and other liabilities going against those bonds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's correct. The law provides presently with respect to claims against the bond that it is not limited to consumers, and that's one of the problems for consumers is that there are claims by financial institutions and other dealers.
I guess if in the incident where you had $240,000 in consumer losses, were there also significant losses by lending institutions and other groups connected to that case?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I'm not sure about that particular case, but typically there is some loss by other entities, though, as I said originally, they're usually much better protected than consumers because they have security interests in the collateral and in the real property and bank accounts and the like.
And in the case of the accountants, is just go way at the end of the line. And plumbers, unless you get your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand, I'm just trying to find the can, but I'm sure it's been there someplace with heavy equipment, dealerships, and trailer houses. And does that include large trucks? Are they exempt, and if so, what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, they are not covered under the -85 amendments. Heavy truck sellers or lessors of heavy trucks are excluded. The reason for the exclusion of those entities, and there are other exclusions as well, beginning on page 1 of the bill, lines 15 through 21, and then over onto the second page. The reason for those exclusions is simply that the history that we've seen over the past 15 years or so of consumer injury has been in the area of recreational vehicle dealers or automobile dealers. We have not seen in our office the kinds of consumer losses that in respect, for instance, to heavy equipment operators or sellers of farm equipment, for example. Those are not the kind of consumer claims that we see, and that's why they're excluded.
Follow-up question.
On a different note, I was looking at the makeup of the governing board, and first of all, I was surprised at who appoints the board, but also the short term of office. In my experience, it takes you a year or more to get up to speed when you serve on the board. And I see some of them are about 18 months.
1 year, the Attorney General serves with the vote appointed by the Attorney General on line 40. On page 6, or for 1 year, those by the Department of Transportation had for 18 months, those jointly appointed for 2 years, and then those balance selected for 2 years. So,
it seemed like very short term.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, the reason for that, ultimately all the members of the board will serve 2-year terms. The reason for the staggering is so that the membership of the board will not all change on the same date every 2 years. So it is true that the initial term of the initial appointees some of them will be shorter than others, but in the end, the board will be maintained by appointments that are of 2-year duration.
Mr. Chair, my point is that most boards that I'm familiar with serve either 3 or 4 years, and they can serve 2 terms. Before they have to fall off. And I don't see any provisions for that at all.
Sure, absolutely nothing. I think there is nothing in the bill that prohibits the reappointment of a board member.
Certainly, with no limit.
Sure, absolutely. There is no limit that I'm aware of in the bill.
Let me just ask some questions relative to that. Now that we know that there's no limit, let's drop down to after the board is appointed on line 18 of page 7 under section 8, upon the authorization of 6-1 members, the governing board may pay the following expenses from the recovery fund. I assume this is probably generated out of the interest of the fund first, which DAF has a responsibility to determine on a FIFO base, first in, first out basis, who that's supposed to be distributed to as to the dealers, but salaries and wages or payments to any persons on the board deemed necessary to employ or retain or for the purpose of relating to payment of claims and duties of the governing board, except that members of the board shall serve without compensation. So
we'd have a salaried person somewhere that administers and oversees this as a department. And then the reasonable travel and lodging expenses of the board members is required for their official duties. And then finally, fees charged by any professional, including attorneys, including hiring members of the AG staff to provide legal counsel as may be required by the governing board. So basically, we have, like our health licensing boards or any of the rescue boards we've talked about, we've got a new board that's set up in this process. Do we have any feel for what those boards are costing us? The cheapest board I saw went out here at nearly $200,000 in a biennium.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that DOJ has similar operations to this recovery fund and that they would absorb the cost because they already are operating in this military budget.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not, I think the board may need to retain a staff person to administer the claims process, so that's a decision the board will make in the end. It's possible the board won't need to do that, but in Virginia and Ontario, I believe both those jurisdictions have retained a staff person, a single staff person to, well, I shouldn't say, Ontario may have more than one, but it is possible that the board would need to retain a staff person to help administer these claims.
I understand that previous inquiries in the Department of Justice, and we're just now getting the fiscal previous inquiry of the Department of Justice indicate that any costs associated with this program would be minimal and could be absorbed between existing staff and resources of the Department of Justice.
Mr. Chair, that's with respect to the claim, to the costs that might be incurred by DOJ as opposed to the administration of the fund. We can cover all of the legal work that we anticipate the fund would require, and we can provide the legal assistance and help them collect the monies that are due them from dealers on whose behalf claims have been paid. But that's different than what might be required to actually process the claims through the board's process.
Okay, and so presently you're already processing claims because it would be failures to comply with consumer law in the state of Oregon. So you're already in the process of doing that. So this isn't any additional work, and that's why you're saying there's no additional staff nor other compensation needed for DOJ. It's just to administer the fund and those kinds of things.
Just sort of a philosophic question. I appreciate the fact that you've been involved in consumer protection in the AG's office, and that's an important thing. Will creation of such a fund make auto dealers more careful in terms of dealing with people or having this fund? Is it going to say, well, you know, we've got this fund, it'll take care of us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Truro, that was one of the considerations that we worried about when we launched into this endeavor. And I'm confident that it will have the opposite effect. And the reason for that is simply this, that if the fund pays out money on behalf of the dealer, the fund has a right to indemnification from the dealer. And the fund has a tremendous hammer.
What does that mean?
That means the fund can get the money back that it has paid out on because of the misconduct of the dealer. And the hammer...
How do they do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trove, there are two ways they can do that. The hammers that they have, first, they have the right to bring a lawsuit against the dealer.
What's that worth if you got a broke dealer that's long started?
Mr. Chair, in the case of a dealer who has gone out of business, of course, that's not going to be a real, that's not a real remedy.
Lawsuits, you just boil it up and put spaghetti sauce on it, it's worth nothing.
That's exactly correct, Mr. Chair. But in the event that this is a dealer who is still in business and who has willfully refused to pay a consumer's judgment, for example, the dealer not only will be sued by the governing board under circumstances in which the dealer has fewer defenses than if they were sued directly by the consumer, which they've already been under our hypothetical. But secondly, the bill directs the Department of Transportation to withhold renewal of that dealer's certificate pending satisfaction of the claim that is owed to the governing board. And as a consequence of that, the dealer is in a terrible strait if they don't agree to reimburse the governing board for that cost. So the governing board has a lot of tools to require the dealer who has caused the loss to reimburse the fund, provided the dealer isn't on a beach in Belize. And that, in that scenario, of course, there's very little that we can do to deter that. But as to dealers who want to try to do the right thing or who just want to be cheap and okay the consumer's judgment, there's a lot of leverage here, and so I think there's very little possibility that dealers will see this as an a license to go forth and do bad things to consumers.
I represent Messer was recognized.
Senator Crowe mentioned that this had been done in the past with other retail type of organizations. I'd like to hear it from you, sir. Has it been done in the past, and if it's not presently enforced, why isn't it enforced?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, this concept has not been tried in the context of car dealers in Oregon previously. There, I am aware of, I wasn't familiar with the particular example Senator Troll used, but I do know of other funds. For example, there was a fund for the cleanup of methamphetamine labs that the legislature funded some years ago, and that fund was depleted in part because there wasn't a tool for replenishing it. I do know that this concept has been used in the two jurisdictions I've described, Virginia and Ontario, and I've examined the statutes in both of those and also examined the actuarial reports for those funds in both jurisdictions. And although, of course, there are differences in detail in the way the funds are structured, I don't see any reason why Oregon's experience will be dramatically different than those jurisdictions. And in those jurisdictions, they haven't had difficulty replenishing their fund. They haven't needed to impose additional fees on dealers. And in fact, in at least one of those jurisdictions, they've suspended all payments into the fund because the interest has been sufficient to cover all the expenses and maintain the fund. Now, Oregon's experience may be a little different than that, but we do at least have those two models for how the fund is operating.
So there's no other retail groups such as furniture stores or pharmacists or any other groups that you're aware of that have this kind of a program in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, I'm not aware of other retail sales. One thing it might be useful to think about in this context is next to the purchase of a house, the purchase of a car may be the single biggest purchase that families make. And if you look at a purchase of the magnitude of a house, there are protections of something like this in the context of the purchase of a house. Not that there's a state fund, but the marketplace has grown up protections to protect consumers in the form of title insurance, for example. So in the two biggest kinds of purchases that consumers might make in the marketplace, houses, there's an elaborate structure to help protect consumers. In the case of cars, there hasn't been an adequate one, and that's what we're trying to address with this bill.
Was the Valley Chevrolet case that you cited?
That's correct.
And they had claims totaling, did you say, $272,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, that's correct. $272,000, 210 victims. That was a case out of Medford.
How long have they been in business when they went bankrupt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, I don't know.
They have fallen under the provisions of this bill where they've been paying into the fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, I don't know the answer to that. I suspect they had been in business longer than that. That they would not have been paying into the fund.
So they would have had claimants that could have claimed funds from the fund. They wouldn't have actually, under the provisions of this bill, been paying into the fund. Did you look into a sliding scale kind of a fee, or if not a sliding scale, a fee that was equally paid by all dealers? And if you did, why wasn't that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, there in the first of the six drafts that the working group looked at, we did have a flat fee, as I recall.
What was that?
I don't recall. I'm sorry. And we found that there was significant opposition to that on the proposition based on the premise that I previously described to you, that the greatest risk to consumers was represented by the newest dealers. And as I say, there's some evidence of that, both in Oregon and elsewhere, though it's certainly not universally the case. And so we have...
Probably several issues, obviously, the notable...
Mr. Chair, Representative Leonard, and there are other exceptions as well.
Representative Nestor, is recognized.
I thought, Chair. I serve on two bank boards, and the government legitimately is very concerned about protecting the customers there.
Somebody check your wallet.
Is there any movement towards audits or any of those type of things, or is it done now for the auto dealers? And you're describing a pretty serious problem, it sounds like. And yet it doesn't sound like there's any way that the government can keep track when there's a dealer that might be getting ready to go out of business. They might be improperly financed or is pulling the capital away from the firm and those kind of things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, the Department of Justice does not have authority to audit the private financial transactions of dealers. Typically, how we find out that a dealer is about to go under is that we begin to get a flood of complaints from consumers that indicate that the dealer is being slow in transferring title or is not providing. Typically, what happens is that dealers who are beginning to fail will begin to pocket the money that consumers pay to them for things like extended service contracts, and then we'll get complaints from consumers who say, I went to get my extended service contract work done, and the extended service contract company told me they didn't have any record of receiving payment. That's typically how we find out about it. The Department of Transportation probably is in a better position to talk about, or Mr. Fuller to talk about, whatever authority may exist for regular audits, but I'm not aware of any.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Darrell Fuller with the Oregon Automobile Dealers Association. I looked, and Kelly Taylor is not in the room at the time.
Just looking
the DMV does have investigators who do have the authority to go into dealerships and look at their payment records in terms of satisfying payments to previous lien holders and making sure that the paperwork is being transacted in an orderly way. It certainly is not of the same scope as a bank audit per se. And DMV is saddled with, I believe, 7 investigators to cover about 3,000 dealers. So they are on a complaint basis only, and too often, unfortunately, they get there when it's a little bit too late. And by that time, the dealers are so far upside down that consumers end up being hurt. But there are specific statutory guidelines on how quickly dealers must satisfy liens, previous liens on vehicles, when they take a vehicle into their inventory and how quickly they have to transfer titles to new lien holders. And when the investigators do go in and check, if that is not being done in an orderly manner, then that certainly raises the red flags and they begin to more carefully monitor those dealers.
Follow up, there's no message. If you could speak to the abandoned Ford issue at this program that has protected those consumers. But it also seems to me like there's a need for either a reserve fund by dealers or some kind of a fallback for dealerships, too, just in cases like I'm familiar with the Bannon Ford.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, in the Bannon Ford case, there were 255 victims. The proprietor of that establishment was subsequently convicted of some criminal offenses involving the closure of that business. I'm sorry, Mr.
How long did he serve?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair. I don't know.
I guess I should say he or she at that point that was convicted of crimes.
Sure, that's correct. However, the conviction, of course, the assets were insufficient to satisfy the consumers, so notwithstanding the criminal conviction, there were, for example, $73,000 in credit life refunds that the proprietor received that should have been passed back to the consumers. The consumers were entitled to those monies. Instead, they were pocketed by the proprietor and I think invested in artwork, I think is what the evidence showed. In addition to that, there were 17 other customers of that business who had paid some $10,000 in premiums for credit life insurance that never reached the insurers. The answer to your question, Representative Messerly, is yes, this fund would have applied, in that case and would have benefited those consumers.
Including, excuse me, let me just ask this, including the insurance companies that did not receive their premiums?
Mr. Chair, no, the fund would not have benefited the insurance companies because the fund only exists for the protection of consumers and an insurer is not, would not be classified as a consumer under the bill.
And had there been a default, for failure to redeem, failure to pay the necessary premium, and then an emancipation or some sort of legitimization of that policy itself, that the consumer or the consumer's heirs could not have been reimbursed out of the fund.
Sure, I'm not sure I understand.
So you got a somebody takes out a goes and buys a $35,000 car and gets consumer credit on it for $30,000 and then dies in a crash and the car is gone and the life insurance hasn't been paid, then the consumer has still been defrauded. At that point, the $30,000 worth of life insurance that would have paid the car off would come back from the fund?
Mr. Chair, whatever damages the consumer suffered as a consequence of the dealer's fraud up to the limit of the of $30,000 per consumer would be reimbursable from the fund.
Oh, the limit, there's still a limit of $30,000 on every consumer. I'm interrupting your question. Someone interrupted my dreams this morning. Can you tell me where it's at that it's $30,000? I didn't see that. I beg your pardon.
If I can, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's on page 5 of the bill, lines 23 through 28. There are two limits. The first limit is on the individual consumer's claim, and that limit is capped at $30,000 per consumer. And the second limit is $250,000 for any combination of claims arising out of the one or more transactions involving the same dealer.
How realistic are those limits? Aren't there likely to be other people that will have claims for larger amounts? And I noticed that it doesn't pay some of the things like pain and suffering or some of those things. So are you still able to go ahead and sue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, yes, the consumer can bring an action, a lawsuit, for whatever the consumer can recover under other sources of law. Their recovery, however, from the fund is limited just to their actual damages. They're not entitled to punitive damages or exemplary damages. Their attorney's fees are limited at $500 unless the governing board, by a majority vote, approves a greater amount. So there will be losses that or judgments that are in excess of $30,000.
Now, as you understand the losses in these various companies that have been experienced, these limits are pretty reasonable for virtually all of the people involved.
Mr. Chair, Senator Crow, I think for the majority of the cases, the $30,000 limit will, per individual claim will be adequate. Now, one category where it may fall short would be recreational vehicles. Dealer failures, those losses per consumer might well exceed that. But for the majority of cases, $30,000 is realistic. And then the $250,000 cap is roughly in line with our historic experience of the maximum loss.
And I did interrupt, but let me interrupt one more time. I beg your pardon. Senator is under call at this time. I've got at least this many members in the quorum. I do need to let you know that we're going to have to come back and revisit the legislative administration budget and the capital budget here relative to our own issues. Thank you very much for signing that bill while I was saying goodbye to my son. That's fine. I enjoyed the opportunity to.
I tried to help you.
And you did a good job. Thank you very much.
I
certainly appreciate that. But I anticipate that at the meetings later this morning that we should have a schedule for perhaps as early as tomorrow to come back and revisit that. So we probably have to
see the legislative branch budget, including the operation of the capital. So,
and the clerk of the Secretary of the Treasury just said that
it was my responsibility to get the two of you up to the attorney. We'll finalize with a question from Representative Messer. Again, thank you for
it. That's fine. It's not a question. I just wanted to finish the story. It was that I heard an abandoned board leadership. The last I heard, that individual was involved in a leadership in Southern California.
Better there than in Oregon.
in that regard, and this is probably almost as fun to close on. I can't find anything in this process. The only people that you could ever exclude from becoming participants under this program would be those who have been convicted of felony or misdemeanor moral turpitude in the last 10 years in the motor vehicle business. So. Any other felons or racketeers could join with impunity.
Mr. Chair, the conviction of racketeering, which I think is the conviction that Mr. Sparks suffered in the case we've been discussing, is a felony. In addition to that, offenses like theft by deception would qualify as a misdemeanor involving moral turpitude.
But it has to be in a sale or lease or motor vehicle to a consumer within the past 10 years.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Sparks would qualify.
Okay. But if it was an art dealer, if he switched back and forth every 10 years, he could certainly qualify.
And I love that Hanson points out that racketeers and legislators would be allowed to do.
And I was going to say something beyond that. I was going to say ministers probably would be excluded under this too. Yeah. Televangelists and those kinds of things. Well, we didn't get through the list, but I do have from examination of the bill, I would like to make sure that we have invited for our next public hearing portion of this someone from the Treasurer's Office, someone from the Department of Administrative Service. I would like the issue of risk management addressed. And then if we could have... Kelly, I put your name on the list of those who would be willing to testify relative to this issue, and we do have, again, I just want to call your attention, Mr. Shepard, that it says that in this process, the fiscal indicates that the Department of Justice indicates any costs associated with this program you're willing to absorb into your budget. So,
Mr. Chair, again, those are the costs that the Department of Justice would incur in providing the legal services to the fund.
Okay. Well, we've got a preliminary fiscal, and we're going to have to come back. And I think what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to figure out what the cheapest board is that we've got in the state and estimate that it's going to be at least that much money to run a board, and then get that kind of a budget projection on it, complete with, I suppose, let's not get the Secretary of State involved, but we need the fees, what it's going to be, and then I would like to have risk management fairly soon make some disclosures here. So, and we will be notified relative to when our next turn on the budget is going to be, and I think we may be able to hear those issues again as early as tomorrow if we plan to get out of the building sometime in the next 2 weeks. So.
Mr. Chair, is it your intent to carry the hearing over until tomorrow, or?
Let's go ahead and let's do this. Let's go ahead and plan to carry it over to 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and let's gavel this portion of the public hearing closed and reopen the public hearing possible work session tomorrow at even time. And then relative to the other budget, it may take precedence and priority if we come back at even time. So we will carry this one over. For no other comments or questions, so thank you very kindly.
Appreciate you, folks.
Yeah, very much.